51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And Thursday night is film review night. And once again this evening, we can talk about films that are going into actual cinemas this week. Up for consideration, Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci play a couple dealing with a devastating diagnosis in Supernova. We're in Soviet Russia for Dear Comrade, which focuses on a real-life massacre and its aftermath. And Liam Neeson is in action mode again for The Ice Road. Paul Whittington, Cara O'Doherty have been watching all three and they're with me this evening. We'll start with Supernova first, from the director Harry McQueen, who we spoke to, in fact, during this year's Dublin International Film Festival. Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci as a couple here, Sam and Tusker, late middle age and facing up to a dementia diagnosis. What stage of life, when I say they're in late middle age, but I suppose it's their professional life really, Paul, that is at the heart of the story that's been told, as well as their personal relationship, clearly.
Yes, in a way, Sean, because Sam is a concert pianist and Stanley Tucci's character, is Tusker, is a novelist, and they're on this journey northward to Sam's sister's house. And little unbeknownst to one of them, there'll be a surprise party. But Tusker has persuaded Sam to perform again. But there is a shadow over all this, of course, because Tusker has early onset dementia. And he's a lot further along in accepting what's going on than Sam is.
Yeah, and the kind of it's not good guy bad guy here, Cara, but there's certainly a very different style of character, if you like. Stanley Tucci's charm and affability and a kind of an American side to that, I suppose, in some ways, and Colin Firth with a very British reticence, it has to be said.
He is very stiff upper British lip, and not able really to deal with emotions too well. And it's just very different. He's reserved. He doesn't like the acclaim that comes with his own fame. And he's just not really able to deal with what's going on with Tusker in the way that Tusker wants to. Tusker wants to talk about it and be open. But Sam's just not able for that conversation just yet.
And let's play a clip of the two of them as they're travelling along. They stop at a roadside cafe and Tusker, Tucci's character, in typical fashion, decides he's going to embarrass the Colin Firth character when the waitress comes over to serve them their food.
Can I ask you, did you want one? An autograph? From him? Because I saw you looking at it. I wasn't sure if you wanted one.
Tusker?
No, it's all right. He's very shy. You normally, do you have a pen on you?
Yes.
All right. But if you want one, he'll sign one for you. He's shy, but he will. Either on a napkin or if you have one of his piano albums, he'll.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thank you. It's very nice of you. Thank you.
How did you come to be this person?
I don't know. I don't even know why I do it, because it really isn't even satisfying anymore half the time, anyway.
So why do you do it?
Because of the other half.
Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth there in a scene from Supernova. And Paul, that really defines the relationship between the two of them. There's a lot of fun and a lot of love, actually, between the two men. That's what's at the heart of their relationship.
Yeah,
really.
They're lovers in the proper sense. There's real intimacy. And, of course, they're now faced with what happens when you face losing it. And Tusker is a great, obviously Stanley Tucci, too often we see him in smaller supporting roles. He's a wonderful actor and he brings so much colour to this character. And he's obviously this very funny, witty man, a brilliant writer and so forth. But he's fading away and he knows it and he's not prepared to accept it. And I think the most touching scene in the film is when he finds a diary.
Colin Firth's character finds a diary.
Finds a diary, and it's where Tusker writes. And at first it seems okay, and as he goes along, you can see the writing going and the train of thought going, and that's devastating.
Yeah, because in many ways, Cara, when you hear a film about dementia and about clearly that one of the characters is not going to last forever, well, nobody is, but in this particular case, we know that there's going to be a difficult ending for him. You might fear that it could be a very somber film, that there might be very little humour in it.
Oh, that's the thing about this. There's just beautifully funny moments. There's a time where they have to sleep in Sam's childhood bed, two grown men fitting into this small bed. And it's just lovely moments like that. They bicker and they fight over songs and directions. They have so much love. And you just know they've had these same arguments for years, but they're happy to have them because they're just, it's their nature. And it's funny and just, there's so much love there. It's beautiful.
Yeah, that childhood bed scene, as you say, is particularly funny. And despite his reticence and his stiff British upper lip, Colin Firth's character uses rude language as he's speaking to Stanley Tucci during this clip. Let's listen to the two of them then, trying to fit into the childhood bed.
You always seem somehow to get your own way, don't you?
Oh, come on, it's cozy.
No, it's ridiculous.
No, it's not.
It's nice. Oh, you're in the middle of the fucking bed, isn't it?
I am on the edge. Now I'm more on the edge.
Are you okay?
That's it. I'm sleeping in the
No, you no, 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 no. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come over here. Come here. Come here.
Yeah, we'll move over a bit.
All right. All right.
Come here. Come here. Come here.
Just I'll keep you. Like, come here. I'll be like a little rail for you, like kids have. There you go. Bed rail. There we go. Is that better?
Just give me some. Don't breathe.
I was trying to stop you.
Yes, Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci trying to fit into Sam's childhood bed there in a scene from Supernova. Paul, I was saying as we were listening to that, the Supernova of the title, I remember watching this and kind of saying, I didn't really get where that title came from and what was being... It's referred to, but it's never really teased out fully, is it?
Well, there's a little scene involving Tusker and Sam's niece, and they're looking up at the sky. He knows a lot about astronomy, and... he's explaining various things to her. So you can imagine that Supernova might be him or what's happened to him or, you know, but no, it's not really gone into in any great detail.
And the other thing that I think it's important here, it just so happens to be a same-sex relationship that's a story that's been told, Cara, but that is, it's not vital to the story in many ways.
No, and I think it's one of the first times that we've seen a film like this. I mean, it's a film about a couple.
Yeah.
Whether they're same sex or not, it's a couple story. And I think it's time that we see more films like this. Obviously, who they are is such part of it, but it's being gay isn't this particular story. It's the story of their love and what they're facing into in the next coming year or two.
Did it work for you, Paul, and Stars to finish up?
Yeah, it very much did. It's a very moving film. It's not especially cinematic, but these two, who I think are friends, are just wonderful together. I like to use a half star, Sean, so I will give it 4.5 stars. The half off is for the incidental music, which I don't think it needed, because you don't have to push the emotion in a film like this.
Yeah, but if the Colin Firth character is a concert pianist, which gives some reason for some of the rather heavy-handed music that's in it, which seems heavy-handed given the subtlety of the performance that are there. And Cara, just the Tusker's decline, what would you say about that as you head in, how they show that to us, and then give us your final judgment?
It's when they finally have that conversation. It's powerful, it's explosive, and it's impossible not to cry. I mean, I was moved to pieces by this. It is a gorgeous, gentle take on pain and grief, and they give the best performances I've ever seen. 5 stars. Go away with that Mr. Whittington and his half star.
No half measures from you, Cara. Did you give a 5 star to something quite recently as well? You must be feeling in particularly good mood now that we're back in cinemas.
I'm about to give 5 stars.
All right, okay. Don't be giving it away before we get there. You've given the
spoiler
end.
Spoiler alert, Paul.
All right, 4.5 and 5. Clearly, both very happy with Supernova, Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth. Let's move on then to Dear Comrades, which we know Paul really likes. Russian filmmaker Andrei Konchalovsky, at the heart of this, tells the true story of a 1962 massacre in the Russian city of Novocherkassk and the brutal and ruthless cover-up that followed. True events that are being told here, Paul, and they really are frightening.
They are frightening. I think this is a remarkable film, Sean, because it does a number of different things at once. It's talking about this incident, which was a massacre of striking workers at this plant in the middle of the Don Valley. It's also giving us a kind of very subtle crash course in the ups and downs of 20th century Russian history to the main character's family. And it's also this family drama and the story of this woman who desperately needs to believe in communism because of all the sacrifices that have been entailed in it.
Yeah, and the main character that he's talking about there, Cara, that Paul is talking about is a woman called Lyuda, played by Yulia Vyostovsky, if I'm saying her name correctly. And she is has collaborated on several occasions with the director. Is that kind of, is that dynamic clear in the performance?
It's not, but it's a fantastic performance. And I didn't realise that they had worked together before. I didn't know that much beforehand. But she is an incredible actor who manages to balance being a woman who isn't that nice at times. But then you realise why and what she has gone through. And that bizarre life of living under regime after regime and desperately following the rules because you need to belong. So she's a multifaceted character and it's a fantastic performance.
Yeah, and she's part of the city council, the local city council, Paul.
She is.
But she's kind of looking for, could bring back the good old days of Stalin.
Oh yeah, yeah, she's nostalgic for Stalin and that happens now. People are nostalgic for communism now because of the certainty it brought. We find out through her story that she was a nurse on the front line during the war. Stalingrad is not mentioned there, but if she could have been there. And she's quite a traumatized person in a way, but she cleaves to this belief. She's sleeping with her boss on the council. She's quite a complicated life. She has a rebellious teenage daughter, and she finds out when this protest starts that her daughter has gone to it.
Yeah, and maybe give us the background to what's happening in the local factory, or that what's causing the local workers such problems, Cara.
So the workers are, food prices are rising, wages are decreasing, and at this particular time the staff of this massive factory are told that their wages are being cut again. So they down tools, they strike, and they think that now under Khrushchev they can do this, but they find out very soon that they can't. The Red Army soldiers and the KGB are sent in to squash any strikers, and they do it through bullets, and they kill numerous people. Casualty numbers couldn't figure them out because people were too afraid to go to the hospitals. And it really was covered up in the most extraordinary way. I mean, an entire town was forced to sign non-disclosure agreements that they didn't see anything. They didn't, like, literally, they washed the blood off the streets within minutes of the shooting to make sure that this thing was covered up. It's an extraordinary event.
And there's a kind of a claustrophobia about the film, Paul, in many ways. And it's the fear of anybody you're talking to at any moment in time could shop on you if you say anything at all.
Yeah, it's a really acute examination of life under totalitarianism. And in fact, if anybody's ever read any Solzhenitsyn, they'll know all about this. But in that society, there were spies everywhere, neighbours, anybody could inform on you. You had to be careful what you said. There's a wonderful scene where Lyuda and the KGB guy, who unexpectedly turns out to have a heart and tries to help her find her daughter when she goes missing, they're waiting in this room wondering will people from the Red Army arrest them or not. And it's just this perfect example of what life in Soviet Russia was like.
Now, I don't know if this was a stylistic choice, but I have to say, and I know that you both are particularly positive about this film, but Cara, there was for me, certainly in the early sections of the film, there was a lot of shouting going on, a lot of people shouting at each other all the time. Now, I know there's confusion and I know that the city council are hardly, they wouldn't strike you as the most efficient group of city councillors ever found, if you can find a very efficient group of city councillors. But everybody seemed to be shouting at everybody all the time. I didn't get nuanced in there. Or was that just me? Was I in a bad mood?
I think they are shouting, but I think they're angry, but they're not allowed to be angry. So they're sort of stuck in this very odd time where emotions are high. They're trying to rein it in and it just comes out in shouting at each other. And I think in a way it was almost a release for everybody that, you know, you can shout across the street, but you can't say what your neighbours are doing. I think it just brings that odd dynamic of what it must have been like to live at that time.
Yeah, and I think her in the domestic setting, she knows that she has two people in her house who are not as enthusiastic about communism as her daughter, who, you know, says, if this is supposed to be the workers' paradise, why can't you strike? And of course the mother says, you don't need to strike, it's the workers' paradise. But and then her father, who because the Don was where the Cossacks were, and they did not kowtow to the Soviets and hated them. And her dad hides a religious icon under his bed, and he pines for the good old days of Tsarism. So everybody's pining for something.
And he still has his old Tsar's uniform. He dresses up in his Cossack gear when he can. And the particularly chilling scene, just one of many that struck me, Cara, was there's a moment when I believe it's a KGB man who's carrying, I think it's a violin case or a cello case, but when he gets up to the attic, he's going to be a sniper. Mm. And he's literally picking off innocent people or just these strikers on the street one by one. It's frightening, the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, when it's just random, the random nature of who he shoots at.
It is, and there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. And even more chilling, I thought, at a moment when people are being forced to sign the non-disclosure agreements, there's a young woman who signs it, and the KGB man asks her a question, and she answers, assuming it's part of the paperwork, and the next thing she's taken away in cuffs, most likely never to be seen again. So, like, How anybody managed to say anything is beyond me. But they did, obviously. Russia survived. But
yeah, and it's shot in black and white, Cara. Does that add to the atmosphere in any way for you?
Absolutely. It added a weight of tension and it created that sense of time. I don't think it would have been as powerful in colour. Mm. It feels every bit 1960s Russia, or what I imagine 1960s Russia to be.
Yeah, it really does get that period aspect of things totally right. Paul, I wonder how many stars you're going to give this film. I just can't guess.
5.5. No, I would if I could. I think it's wonderful. Cara talked about the black and white, which I entirely agree with. It would have been a different film in colour when you think about it. But there's all these beautiful compositions, all these weathered faces of people who've lived through the war and what followed it. And it really gets, I think it's a kind of masterpiece, actually. It really gets very close to what life under totalitarianism was.
All right, so 5 and 5.5 if he was allowed from Paul Whittington. I suppose you'll be looking for 5.5 now as well, Cara, will you?
Well, now that he's said it, now I'm okay with his half stars.
What are you going for?
It's a stunning piece of filmmaking, so a second 5-star for me this week.
A second 5-star, 2 out of 3. Let's see if The Ice Road manages to make it anywhere up to that level there. If Liam Neeson is in action here, older action man type, it would have to be, I'd have to say, become synonymous with ever since Taken. And, of course, the famous vengeful phone call. Who's he? He's not going to find somebody and kill them this time. He's going to find somebody. He will find them and he will rescue them this time, Paul.
Yes, he will save them. He's 69 now, you know, Sean. Mm. And this is his umpteenth action movie. He keeps saying he's going to give them up and then he comes back for more. So they must be paying him. He plays this guy called Mike, and he has a younger brother called Gertie who has PTSD. He was an Iraq war veteran, and he Liam Neeson is an ice driver, those people who drive across the lakes of Manitoba and elsewhere in the winter months, and they're always getting fired for various reasons. They're both intemperate in different ways.
This is him and his brother.
Him and the brother, yeah. They're a bit of trouble, and they've just been sacked when they hear about this disaster at a Manitoban diamond mine. And they agree to help drive trucks up there with a drill bit to help free the prisoners. But the problem is it's April and the ice is melting.
Yeah, you can't drive on the ice road if there ain't ice. Yeah, no, it becomes very thin and the trucks are very heavy. Where does Lawrence Fishburne fit into this story then, Cara?
So Lawrence Fishburne is a character called Jim, and he owns a haulage company. So he knows this route like the back of his hand. But he literally knows every inch of the ice. And he also knows the miners who are trapped. So he's determined that he's going to go on this mission. He's going to take one truck. Neeson and the brother will take another. And a young woman called Tantu, played by Amber Midthunder, she's a Native American, she is going to drive another truck because her brother is trapped in the mine.
All right. So it's tension all the way. In the scene, certainly, that we're about to hear, there's a bit of that there. Mostly scary sounding ice, but I have to admit, not a lot of dialogue. Jim's truck starts to malfunction on the ice sheet, and you'll hear that. Jim, played by Lawrence Fishburne, and Liam Neeson as Mike on the radio to each other.
Sounds like my head gasket.
Yeah, that's one of the more colourful lines of dialogue in the film, Paul.
Yes, he also says at one point, "You can kiss my Irish arse." But it's somebody wrote this, Sean. Mm. It's not very sophisticated. It's like those. I don't know if you remember if you used to sneak out B movie thrillers in the 80s from the Extravision, and some of them had Rutger Hauer in them. It's kind of like them. Mm. It's just a bit silly, but there's skidoos in it. I like a skidoo.
Can you explain?
You know the things you drive on the ice, what do you call them?
Skidoos.
Yeah, skidoos. I like them, yeah.
The other thing that struck me, I thought at one point I was watching yet another airport, except that it wasn't an airport movie. Here, Cara, because guys had come out of offices holding phones and they'd be shouting down the phone, "We've got to get there and we've got to get there now." Mm. There's no nuance here at all. You know what you're going to get from the very start.
Well, but the big surprise of this film is that I thought it was just about the rescue. I thought the ice was going to be the problem. Mm. But there's bad guys who don't want the miners rescued. Ooh. So they also have ninjas on. I call them snow jets. Now, I don't know what Paul's after with the skidoo.
Cara, in Canada, we call them skidoos.
Oh, right.
Okay. Oh, sorry, right. Well, there's ninjas on skidoos. There's bombs. There's dangerous Christmas trees. I mean, everything gets thrown into this. Yeah. It's just extraordinary.
It is.
Oh, that sounds as if you loved it. Are we heading towards 3 fives? Is it worthy of the wonderful Liam Neeson in this film, Paul Whittington?
No, it's not at all, actually. And he has been in some ropey ones. This is quite ropey. A couple of years ago, I'm sure you saw Ordinary Love.
Oh, that was an amazing film.
That shows you what an understated naturalistic actor he can
this be. This was a film where who was it played his wife? She was diagnosed. She had a cancer diagnosis. And it was just about this wonderful relationship and the support that he gives her, all shot up in and around Belfast. Yeah. And beautifully and naturalistic.
Yeah, absolutely. And he, that's what he can do. But that's not what he does in these films. And as I say, he gets paid for them.
Oh, yeah, he does. Stars, or skidoos, I suppose you'll be handing out for this one.
A generous 2 skidoos for me, Sean, yeah.
All right. Are you in accord on this one as well, Cara?
I shall join in the 2 skidoos. Yeah. That is my new word for the day, skidoo.
All right, 2 skidoos, and neither of you particularly happy, it would seem, with The Ice Road, which is available on Amazon Prime, not in cinemas now. There you go. There's an interesting thing. Cara Doherty and Paul Whittington, Supernova is in cinemas from tomorrow, and Dear Comrades is on at the IFI from tomorrow as well. Leslie Manville is the name of the actor we were looking for acting opposite. Yep. Liam Neeson just sent in to me. Thank you for that. Rowan Gillespie is one of the great sculptors in Irish art. Now he's taking on a new project, The Bronze Specialist, most famous for his works on themes like W.B. Yeats, The Famine and James Joyce. But his most recent work is a memorial to the thousands of Irish women who were sent to the penal colonies of Van Diemen's Land, as it was then, modern-day Tasmania, during the 19th century. The documentary, Shape of History, follows Gillespie's process, digs deeper into a fascinating period in history. The documentary is showing this evening on RT television. I'm delighted that Rowan Gillespie is with me in studio this evening. This is an extraordinary story, Rowan, in terms of these Irish women, Irish, Welsh and English and Scottish, these islands really. But you're concentrating, I think, for the most part on the stories of Irish women. How did it come to you that this was the potential subject for another set of sculptures?
Well, there was a competition for it, and this comes down to the thing that in the competition they were saying, we are looking for something along the lines of Rowan Gillespie's sculpture on the Keys of Famine. And that's when I thought, you know what, I might submit for this one. I don't normally do that. And lo and behold, I got the job. So there I was winging off down to Australia and Tasmania for the first time in my life, thinking, well, this is great. This is good.
And in some ways, I was saying to you that it links in the fact that your famine sculptures, which many people will know along the Keys in Dublin, we're seeing people leaving the country. In the case of these, Footsteps is the name of the project itself. What we're seeing is some of those people arriving on the other side of the journeys that they made. But these particular women were sent to Tasmania at the time for the smallest of misdemeanors.
They were, because you've got to sort of connect it to the abolition of slavery. In effect, the empire was looking around and saying, well, we can't have slaves any longer. so what are we going to do? Now, it was deemed then that a prisoner would have no rights. So you could take a prisoner and make them work. You could make them do whatever you wanted. But take a situation where you say that the minimum sentence is 7 years and you transport them to the other side of the world for labour. They're never going to get back. They're never going to get out of it. So you've actually got a slave for life. So these women were a commodity. They were not, this is not coffin ship stuff. These women were fed. They were given meat before they went. They were the healthy ones were chosen for the journey.
In fact, I think it's, is it the historian Garrard O'Toole mentioned at one stage in the documentary that these were considered, it's a terrible term, but he's right when he uses it, breeding stock.
It's a very accurate term, though. They were doing the laundry along the Magdalen Laundries lines. I mean, one of the earliest examples of that. But they were giving birth nonstop. Mm. They were the breeding stock. But they never kept the child. So it really comes into breeding stock territory, because after they'd weaned the child, it was taken away straight away and sent to the orphanage because the woman couldn't work with a child around her.
An all too familiar story in many ways, unfortunately.
It's the beginning of something which has gone on, you know, which has been around till so recently.
Yeah, absolutely. The decision to go to Tasmania and to start the research is done there. What was the process of the way you found how you were going to honour these women? Let's face it, from the 19th century, you had to find something in the 21st century to link into that.
That really came to me sort of by going with a blank mind, by sort of really not knowing what I was going to do, because it was only a research trip to begin with. But then when I discovered that really anybody you met was, if you dug deep enough, was the descendant of a convict. I mean, this went right through to the governor's husband, and, you know, it's all over the place, but it was very much buried within the families, a thing they call the convict stain over there.
In fact, I have a clip from the documentary where you start off, you're telling us, the viewer, the essence of what you've just said, but you're in a restaurant as you're telling it to us, and at that moment then, the waitress comes over to serve you and you hold a conversation with her. So you first and then that conversation.
And I think she says...
You'll hear what she said. I have the clip here of her actually saying it. So let's have a listen to her. You first, then her.
I was just looking everywhere for ideas and would buy a drink in a bar or something, and I'd ask the girl serving me, well, are you descendant of a convict? And again, the answer was yes.
My favourite one is Marianne Donovan. She stole a man's purse, and that's why she was sent out here.
Where was she from?
I think she was from Cork. I'm not entirely sure. My mum and myself, I suppose, we are more intrigued, want to know more about this side of the family. But the older generations really want to brush it under the carpet like it never happened.
Again, an all too familiar story. That's a clip from The Shape of History, which is a documentary telling of the Rowan Gillespie project that Rowan was telling me about this evening in the studio. It is extraordinary, and I'm sure she was not the only person to say to you, oh no, that's not spoken about.
Yes, until we got the thing going. Mm. And then when it suddenly came up that this idea I had that I was going to use descendants as my models and use them, in effect, their DNA as a conduit to the past, which suddenly seemed to work extremely well. I felt the right then to sculpt them because, you know, I was involving myself with the people of Tasmania. But then, of course, all the mothers started to come along and say to their daughters, do you know what? I haven't told you this, darling, but we do have 5 convict ancestors or something like that. And so I realised there was something happening which was changing convict stain to convict pride.
Yeah.
And that was very relevant and valuable to the whole thing, I think.
It's interesting, though, you say there when you're talking about it, Ron, you talk about the right to tell these stories. Now you're telling the stories through sculptures, obviously, and it harks back to something that you say in the documentary about your own father. You have a Quaker background. Your own father, when you told him about the your famine project, he was not keen on this at all.
No, he would never look at it, never saw it in his lifetime. And I remember saying to him, you know, it's gone really well, Dad. You know, there's photographs. It's in the newspapers. Wouldn't look at it. I think, you see, that is the shame that we've got attached to the famine. In any famine village, if you had 30 houses there, 28 of them either died or emigrated and two were left. You have to ask, what did those families do to survive? What happened? Mm. And so I think within the country here, there's a lot of shame which comes down. Now, I have no idea if there's something in my family history, but I'm a great believer that if there is, one needs to expose it and accept it in order to get rid of the shame.
And there was also, there's a Quaker aspect or to the story that's told in Tasmania as well. A woman out there, again, in one way you could look at what she was doing positively, in another way you could look at it negatively. I can't remember her name. Perhaps you know the woman, the historical figure who ran one, who was involved in one of the...
Elizabeth Fry was, she was doing a lot to teach the women how to sew, how to do domestic work, and gave them sort of packages to travel with, so they'd be doing embroidery on the, you know, on the journey, 3 month journey. They would be on deck every day. Their bedclothes would be aired. This is not coffin ship type stuff. The most senior person on each ship was the surgeon, not the captain, and his job was to get the breeding stock there alive.
Yeah, and again, we can look at that positively and negatively, in that, yeah, they were basically being made more economically viable as they arrived. Yeah. You mentioned this idea of, obviously, if a woman had a child with her, that was not useful, because the child would get in the way of the woman's ability to work. Let's listen to a clip featuring Professor Hamish Maxwell-Stewart. He's talking about the use of the word orphanages, because the children were separated from the parents on the keys, from the mothers on the keys. And mother sent up the hill to the factories.
And they'd have no idea that would happen until that moment.
And here's how Hamish Maxwell-Stewart refers to those, in inverted commas, orphanages.
It's, you know, absolute total cheek to call it an orphanage. It's not an orphanage. The bulk of people who were in the, or children that were in the orphanage, had parents. They knew who the parents were. But they'd been decoupled from the parents in order to increase the utility of the parents' labour. The orphan school was an appendage of the factory system, of the penal stations, of the road gangs, of the chain gangs. It was part and parcel of a way of ensuring that those that were transported after they became free and their offspring knew their place and knew what to do.
Clip once again there from The Shape of History, which is the documentary showing on RT Television at 10:15 this evening, around Rowan Gillespie's Footsteps project. One of the most moving moments for me in the documentary, and I think for you as well, Rowan, was when you then unveiled the finished product to the models themselves.
It's in any situation with a model, that is always a bit tense.
But you were carrying their stories in some ways.
Because, yes, I'm trying to tell their story and I'm not trying to make them look pretty or anything. Mm. So you're not complimenting them, but trying to give them dignity and tell the story. And, I mean, really, if they had got their backs up against the sculptures, it would have been very difficult for me. And this happens to artists all the time, especially when you do things like portraiture.
Yeah.
People never like the portrait you do of them. Always better to do dead people, I find. Sort of keep away from the living.
But the other aspect that I think you say quite early on, which you refer to bronze as being the goddess of them all in terms of media, but it's the fact that you were sculpting these women in bronze. The women themselves would never have thought that they would be elevated in that way, because bronze would be considered the great way to commemorate, really, wouldn't it, in terms of statuary?
It would. And I realised that you did mention at the beginning that I've done sculptures of W.B. Yeats and James Joyce and Archbishop Hughes, you know, so many people, like all men. And so, of course, the time came when I thought, well, what happened to the women? What about the women, particularly sculptures I've done over in the States of men who became very successful in one lifetime over there? What happened to the women? Most of them went to London, not to the States, went into prostitution or service in a house where they probably got raped and became pregnant. So they both finished up as being pretty much the same thing. So of the ones who were transported from England, probably a third were Irish. So you have a huge number who were actually Irish, even if they didn't go from Dunleary.
Yes. And that's another beautiful thing that you do, that when you're taking one of the statues out, you know that that particular character left from Dunleary. And even though it was going to go, the statue was going to be transported from Dublin Port, you felt, no, we'll bring the statue to Dunleary to leave from here.
Yeah, I had to bring Biddy to Dunleary. I mean, it seemed very stupid at the time, but when I live in Blackrock, it wasn't really a very long journey. And they were so helpful at the harbour when I said, could I pop her up there for an afternoon?
Yeah.
They just straight away said, yes, you know, we'll open it up for you to go along there. And it gave an opportunity for people walking on the pier to actually realise this dark history behind the place. 13,000 women, 2,000 children going from there.
And it's just lovely to see the statue standing there, and it kind of brought me back thinking, well, that woman stood there in 18-whatever, possibly the same fashion, looking out at the sea, thinking, where am I going? Where are they bringing me to?
But also it goes on to very recently. You think how many women left for shame, times. For different reasons, up to very recently.
Finally, Rowan, at the end of the film, it's dedicated to Hannah Gillespie. You might tell us who she is and why it's dedicated to her.
Hannah is my wife, who unfortunately passed away this very day a year ago. And it is a total coincidence that the documentary is being shown on this day. Well, it seems to be, but somehow I feel Hannah's behind it, so the documentary is being dedicated to my darling wife, Hannah.
That's beautiful. Rowan Gillespie speaking to us about The Shape of History, which is on RT1 Television 10:15 this evening. Elizabeth Price is a Turner Prize-winning artist whose videos reflect her interest in technology, history, politics and pop music. They incorporate intricate layers of text, moving images and sound design, and they certainly bear repeated viewing. New exhibition of her work, Choreograph, opened this week at the Void Gallery in Derry. Features five films. The Teachers, which is a work which deals with ways in which we communicate without words. And Footnotes, a series of short videos, four in fact, which deals with certain words in some ways, their etymology and their social history around them. Things like the stiletto heel, the university gown, the origins of coal, and finally the lungs. Delighted to have Elizabeth Price join me now on the programme this evening. I want to talk about Footnotes, if I could, first, and particularly the first in the series, which I must say, it kind of tickled my fancy in a peculiar way, the way you link things in here, Elizabeth. The stiletto heel. Maybe you could describe what you were looking at with the stiletto heel, and that word particularly, stiletto.
Yeah, I suppose a number of works in the show kind of link together the idea of dancing, singing, and writing, and you know, relate them to technology. And I was just very fascinated by the connections between the stiletto heel, which was a shoe of fashion in my own teenage years, and you know, the relationship of that word, the stiletto, which is, I mean, many people will know that word is related to the Italian word for a needle-shaped blade, but that word in turn is derived from the ancient Greek word for a pen. And also the word style is related to that Greek word for pen, stylus. So I was just interested in these kinds of connections between you know, writing and the culture of pop music and dance, and starting off with the stiletto heel and ending up with the stylus of the phonographic player.
Yeah, the old LP stylus, the old record player. Of course, we're back to all of that now with the resurgence of vinyl, and the styluses and the involvement of the stylus in that. The four works in Footnotes were all made during the lockdown period. How did that affect how you approached things, would you say, Elizabeth?
Yeah, well, that was a commission that I was given purely because of COVID, really. I was working with Art Angel, the organisation that commissioned the teachers, and we were preparing for an exhibition of it, and we had to stop because of COVID. So Art Angel commissioned me to make this series of works related to it, and I made them in my studio in complete isolation. I used materials like sounds and melodies that I had already made, so I kind of repurposed lots of elements, animations, and also I kind of created props within my studio in isolation and shot them all in infrared light, so I couldn't see them. It was complete darkness. I could only see through my camera to kind of intensify this sense of isolation and the kind of slight survivalism of just kind of repurposing these elements from different or existing projects.
The other thing, one of the other sections of Footnotes is a piece called Coal, where you, is it a list, are they all towns or townlands or places in Yorkshire that are listed at the beginning of that piece? And maybe you tell me what the idea behind that was.
Yeah, they are all the names of coal mines, pits in the coal fields in mainly in England, in the Midlands and in Yorkshire and up in the northeast. And I suppose I was interested in I'm interested in the subterranean architectures of coal mines, in what remains underneath the ground, although the coal mining industry is now extinct largely, that those kind of subterranean architectures remain, and also indeed that what, you know, that coal itself is evidence of this kind of the prior existence of these carboniferous forests. And so, I mean, that piece really kind of connects the place names associated with coal mining with the kind of names of the plants and the species that existed there, you know, millions of years prior and led to the creation of coal.
So the four pieces of footnotes then, how would you say they relate to or have grown out of the teachers?
Well, The Teachers is one of a trilogy of works. So there are three works together that make up that trilogy. And the footnotes are, in a sense, are kind of unpicking certain kind of strands of knowledge that are maybe deeply embedded in that work. So that are not really the subject matter of that trilogy, but that trilogy is based on them. So The Teachers, in a way, deals with this kind of fiction of academics and professional classes kind of being affected by a contagion of muteness. And one of the things I was interested in were the kinds of rituals or the robes that academics or judges wear. So in the footnotes, there's a short film which deals with the history of the academic robe and you know, how that originated. And each of the footnotes, in a sense, pulls out a thread of that larger trilogy of works and just mines it.
I want to listen to a clip from The Teachers, and it deals with this whole idea of these are academics speaking in words, in a way, the way we're about to hear it, but they're talking about the fact that people won't use words to speak. Let's have a listen to that.
Whilst the majority of the group kept silent,
they were almost entirely mute.
Those that did use voice tended to make a narrow range of sibilant, spirant utterances. An unusual mass against the European languages, at least,
of supraglottal sounds.
They did.
No.
As the group became became the subject of journalistic and academic inquiry, as well as legal investigation. The need arose, too.
And that's just a little section there from the teachers. One of the pieces that Elizabeth Price is showing at her exhibition In the Void in Derry at the moment. I saw an online version of these, Elizabeth, but what I really would love to see, I believe they're quite big, and for the teachers in particular, you were talking about four very large screens. Maybe you describe the type of imagery that we see on the screens, as well as the words that are spoken there. We see a digital version of the words being printed up on the screen in front of us. But what else are we seeing?
Yeah, so it's a projection. It's a working projection, but with four synchronized projections. And the projectors are turned on their side, so they're kind of vertical or portrait format. And each of those projections is 3 meters high. So the whole work of these four projections side by side is about 7 meters by about 3 meters. But I use projection to magnify things. So often I take rather small subject matters and make them very big. And in this instance, the imagery is all derived from fashion photography from the period between, I'd say, the late 60s and the early 90s, and particularly of women's formal dress. So the kind of long dresses that very wealthy women would wear to kind of formal or civic events. And I was particularly interested in this fashion photography because the models would make these kind of rather theatrical gestures, largely to kind of display the luxurious nature of these dresses. But when extracted from the magazine context, these gestures seemed like they might bear some different content. Yeah. They seemed very solemn, very grave, maybe a kind of gestures of lamentation or protest.
Anybody with a pair of ears will have noticed the quality of the music there. And there is a big music background in your life, isn't there?
Well, yeah, it's a long time ago now, but in my late teens, I was in a couple of bands, and I was very involved in post-punk music, and that was really the first kind of art world or kind of artistic activity that I was involved in, and through kind of making work in video. I have reincorporated my interest in music and particularly in vocal composition. So in the teachers, they're the four voices, they're synthetic voices, but I got them to sing by pitch shifting them and, harmonise them.
You see, it all comes back eventually. We can't get rid of our past, can we? That's Elizabeth Price speaking to us about her exhibition Choreograph, which is at the Void Gallery in Derry until the 21st of August. You can find out full details on derryvoid.com.